The Musician's Map ebook is the new definitive guide on building success in music. Whether you're just starting out, or you're looking for gigs, or you're trying to make a career, the Musician's Map ebook is right for you. The Musician's Map ebook contains 20 years of music industry experience distilled into a 40,000 word guide to achieving your goals in music. Can't read? Get the Musician's Map audiobook. 4.5 hours of author Kane Power speaking directly into your own ears. That's right, even you can still benefit from the Musician's Map guide to building success in music. Head to musiciansmap.org/books right now to get your copy of the Musician's Map ebook or audiobook. Get it today and receive a special one-time-only offer of a personal pat on the back from author and podcast personality Kane Power. The Musician's Map ebook and audiobook is also available at Amazon and Audible if you feel like supporting those giant websites as well. The Musician's Map ebook, your guide to building success in music. Proof of purchase required for pat on the back. To receive a pat on the back, you must travel to Raglan, New Zealand. Travel not included in purchase price. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the podcast. We've got an amazing episode for you this week, featuring Serena Cherry from Bristol post-hardcore post-metal band Svalbard. Svalbard are signed to Holy Raw Records and are about to release their second full-length album on the 25th of May, titled It's Hard to Have Hope. Serena talks about how she started playing guitar, how she got into heavy music, and how Svalbard signed to Holy Raw. We also discuss being a female in a male-dominated scene, intentional composition, and her passion for roller coasters. We caught up over Skype.
So I started playing the piano when I was 4 years old, which is really young. And I started that early because my older sister had just started playing, and I was always kind of playing catch up with her. Whatever she was doing, I wanted to be doing it as well. Yeah. So I begged my mum to let me learn the piano as well. And then after years of that, I learned the violin as well. And I always used to get massively told off because I played by ear. So all the music teachers just hated me because I never looked at sheet music. I would always just pick things up by ear, which apparently is the wrong way to play music. And then at age 12, I started getting into metal. Specifically, it was through the PlayStation game MTV Sports Snowboarding, it had a Fear Factory song on the game, and I remember hearing it. It was Edge Crusher, and I was like, wow, this guy is shouting. Oh my God, it's the angriest thing I've ever heard. So I saved up my money from my paper round that I did and bought the Fear Factory album, Obsolete, when I was 12, and that got me into metal. So I decided I wanted to start playing the drums. So I went for drum lessons, and I basically just wanted to be Joey from Slipknot. Mm-hmm. I learned for a year, but again, I felt like music lessons, I found them really restrictive, and I found they never really wanted to do what I was passionate about. Like, they always wanted to teach you snare rudiments and boring stuff, and I just wanted to play double kick and play fast. So annoyingly, for my mum, who'd bought me the drum kit, I gave up on the drum lessons after about 2 years and said, right, I'm going to learn guitar. That's going to be my thing. And my mum went, well, you're on your own. You know, I'm not supporting you anymore. And I think that was kind of the perfect thing to do, because when you're a teenager, it's good to be discouraged because it makes you want something. It makes you go, well, this is, you're really determined. You're like, this is my thing that I want to do. So you persevere with it even more. So I saved up all my paper round money for over a year to buy this really crap imitation Flying V from my local guitar shop. And because I couldn't afford lessons. I taught myself how to play guitar. So I've never had a guitar lesson. I would just sit there and watch music videos and kind of try and watch what people's fingers were doing and what shapes they were in. And again, like just play by ear, really. So I never had a guitar lesson. And then a real game changer for me was I started doing work experience in a guitar shop when I was 15 years old, and then they ended up giving me a job, and I worked there for years, where I just got to sort of play around with effects pedals and play around with guitars and amps and really kind of figure out what I liked sound wise and that being able to do that in the shop without having to pay for things was really kind of helpful. Yeah. In learning like what equipment I liked and what guitars I liked and stuff. So that was definitely, that's something I'd recommend any young person doing, is try and get work experience in a music shop.
Yeah, I did that as well, actually. So you just dove, you picked up an electric guitar, first guitar as a Flying V, and you just started playing Fear Factory songs and Slipknot songs, like just off the bat? Or were you like, okay, this is a D and here's an A?
I was shit for ages. Like, I was really bad for ages. And I didn't, to be perfectly honest with you, I wasn't that fussed about learning other people's songs. I more used it as just to try and like write stuff that sounded like those bands. I sort of figured out the bare basic chords. I mean, like, a few, but I never really knew what I was doing. I didn't know any scales, and I was a really, really bad guitarist for a really long time.
Yeah.
And the only reason I bought a Flying V was because I really struggled to play standing up. And if you buy the Flying V, you have to sit in classical position when you play sitting down.
Yeah.
So it forced me into that position. That was the only reason I bought.
I was going to ask what attracted you to heavy music, but you kind of answered, the snowboarding game on PlayStation.
Yeah, I think it was kind of as well with new metal. Like, new metal had a real aesthetic to it. Yeah. It was just as much about how crazy and exciting the bands looked as much as how they sounded, which I think when you're 12, 13, that's the coolest thing ever, is seeing 9 dudes in like boiler suits and masks and stuff. It really strikes a chord with your imagination.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely is also something that drew me towards metal and stuff. And then, yeah, the kind of expressiveness of the music as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What were the people around you? How did they think about you kind of getting into something so extreme, especially with Slipknot? Because back then, their first record, it was really quite extreme.
It was, yeah. I didn't really have any friends at school.
Yeah.
I was the weird... Do you remember when, like, the weird goth kid was a thing?
Yeah.
Now you see groups of them. They're always in groups now, and they kind of find their little fellow goths or emos or whatever to run around with. But back in my day, if you were into that kind of thing, you were an outsider and you were quite isolated. I think, yeah, I sort of definitely think that that went hand in hand with being a bit of a loner. Like, so I didn't really have many friends, and I was definitely the only person that was into metal. I mean, my mum wasn't shocked or surprised by it at all, because she's a musician as well, and she's a record collector, so she's like really, really into music, and her living room is full of vinyl, so she's cool, like she gets it. I never had the whole kind of rebelling against a parent thing.
Yeah. I want to talk about the kind of masculinity of that style of music, and how you were attracted to that sort of music, and whether the sort of masculinity was off-putting, or if it was awkward kind of getting into it being a female?
Oh, definitely. Like, I did actually just, because I write about music as well, I write for a few publications. I just wrote a piece on this the other day for International Women's Day.
Oh, really?
And I was just highlighting even just a simple thing, as when I worked in the guitar shop, people didn't want to take advice from me. Like, people didn't want to hear about a girl who knew about guitars or knew about amps or effects pedals. And it was the same with getting into metal. You very much felt like you were invading a male-dominated space. And people used to question you all the time. Like, you never see it happen to guys, but especially when I got into the heavier stuff like black metal, you'd go to a show and you'd wear a shirt of a band you like, and people would say, oh, you don't really like them, oh, name all of their albums, and they question you as if you're not into it. Or, oh, another one a lot of people say is, you only listen to that because your boyfriend likes it, and my boyfriend doesn't even listen to metal. So
yeah.
it's just, you know, it's quite frustrating that you only seem to receive that doubt when you're a female.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see other guys getting the doubtful treatment and the suspicious treatment, but it definitely is a hugely male-dominated scene. But I think it is changing, and like, there are definitely positive changes that are being made, especially in the last couple of years, and things like the internet really help because they give women a platform to talk about their passions and their interests.
Yeah.
Where they don't, you know, it's kind of a safe discussion space, I guess.
Growing up in a similar kind of scene, it was obviously, really male dominated, especially the people in bands. It was rare to see a female in an extreme music band. And I was just yesterday doing a tiny bit of research before talking to you. I was looking at the Holy Roar artist lineup page. There are 142 mm-hmm. men and there are 8 women.
Wow.
And that kind of, because Holy Roar is such a kick-ass label and I love it. And I love most of the bands on it. but it just kind of, it just sort of highlighted again, like I thought 15 years ago or longer, 20 years ago, you know, you kind of look around and you see some females in the crowd and you're like, okay, things are, you know, slowly changing, but are they changing fast enough, or have they changed that much if it's still that ratio?
That's a really good question. I think it's a very slow progression. Like, to me, I look at Holy Roar and I see that they have far more women in their bands, in their roster, than most labels do. If you look on many small independent labels or lineups of festivals, sometimes, you know, there can be one girl or none. So I actually think I've always regarded them as being kind of at the forefront of equality within that music scene. However, when you put it like that, it makes me go, oh, yeah, like there is a huge disparity between the representation of women. But I, as someone who's been going to gigs and been playing music for nearly 15 years, I've definitely seen a change. Like, with my own eyes, I've seen crowds become a more percentage of girls. Like, there were shows that I went to when I was a teenager where I was the only girl there, and that doesn't seem to happen now. There's definitely women more attending shows, more feeling like it's a more welcome space for them. And then also just with female musicians in general, if you look at sort of the last year, we had like Venom Prison and Employed to Serve and all those bands really taking the forefront of the media for metal. So there's definitely been more representation. I don't know if you get it in New Zealand, but Metal Hammer did a women only issue last month.
Cool.
And it was amazing. Like, they had Nightwish on the cover, so straight away I loved it because they're my favorite band. I'm actually just a big cheese monger. I just listen to cheese. But when they did that issue, I mean, it kind of, if you look at it in the vast scheme of things, that's one issue with a woman on the front compared to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of issues that haven't, but it's a positive change.
Yeah.
So I think it's very slowly progressing.
Yeah, it is. And I think the more covers like that, and the more, you know, bands like Svalbard and Roller Tomasi coming and getting a bigger and bigger audience and releasing cool music, it's going to appeal to younger girls who are thinking, you know, maybe they feel a little bit on the outside, or maybe they're thinking about getting into that music, and then they see these role models playing it and go, yeah, it is okay, and it's actually kind of cool.
Oh, thank you.
How did Svalbard form? How did you start that band?
So I used to do a solo project, like a really indulgent, weird noise effects pedals project.
Yeah.
And I played a show supporting a prog band, and the driver for the tour of the prog band was wearing a Dying Fetus t-shirt.
Yeah.
And I went up to him and was like, oh, I like Dying Fetus, as you do.
Yeah.
And we realized that we liked a lot of the same bands, so we started jamming. So that was Liam, who I met at that show. And we started just sort of meeting up to sort of share ideas on guitar, and we recorded a couple of demos down. And then we met Mark, our drummer, at the same music studio. So he was rehearsing with his other band, a thrash band, who we... You know how you kind of know each other through the local scene where everyone knows each other's bands and stuff.
Yep.
And that was how the three of us met. And then we went through hundreds and hundreds of bassists.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think we've just about settled on Adam, who's our current bassist now. I mean, he's been quite long running in the band. He's lasted over a year, which is impressive. Normally they last a couple of months and then they go, oh, this actually involves commitment and sacrifice, so I don't want to do it.
what is it about bassists that can't commit?
I don't know. I mean, I guess playing bass is quite dull, so maybe there's not as much in it for them.
Oh no, all the bassists just pushed stop on the podcast.
Oh, sorry.
No, it is. It's a recurring. I'm a drummer, and so generally drummers are in three or four bands, because it's hard to find drummers. But I've gone through more bassists than any other musician, as well. Yeah. Every it seems.
Oh, that's
it seems
interesting.
Just churn through the bassists.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
It kind of. Yeah, it is. So you guys, I noticed you released three EPs. And one or two splits before recording your debut album. Was that just because you were finding your sound, or what was the sort of thinking behind that decision?
It's partly financial, because it costs a lot more money to go into a studio for 2 weeks to record an album than it does to go in for 2 days to record an EP. So it was partly, and because we didn't have a label at the start, we would really struggle to fund and release an album. So we just wanted to have some tracks recorded that we could give to people and sort of spread around and get the word and get people interested first, because making an album is a commitment. And I don't think it's something that bands should jump into straight away.
Yeah.
And then the other part would be, we were still finding our feet. We were still honing our sound. The first EP that we did, we had a vocalist on, like a different singer. And then, he left the band, and that changed the sound as well, again, once Liam and I started doing the vocals instead. So there was definitely a lot of finding our feet. But also, the reason there's so many EPs is because we find it easier to write four songs in one quick splurge than to write an album. When you're writing, because with an album, you're writing sort of 8 to 10 tracks, and we're quite meticulous with our process. We do a lot of kind of arguing and worrying about whether songs are good and stuff. Whereas when we would write an EP that was three or four songs, it was just a fresh batch off the, you know, we didn't have to worry about it too much. Whereas an album, I think you definitely put a lot more thought and critique into your own work.
Something that I encourage artists to do is to do EPs, do demos, and think long and hard before recording an album, because it is a massive commitment and it's a huge undertaking, because so many people jump straight into it. They form a band, they rehearse, they write 10 songs, and they record an album, and then they release it, and then the album does nothing, and they go, better give up the band or something. But the difference between releasing your first EP to releasing your debut album, like night and day?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, completely. I mean, when we released our first EP, we're basically releasing to disinterest. You know, we didn't have a fan base. We didn't have that many people that would attend our shows or people that had even heard of us at all. We were, you know, fresh and trying to prove ourselves, which is a very different place to be in compared to having a label. I think once a label turns around and says, yes, we want to back this band, we are so confident in their music that we're going to, you know, release their album, that's a huge vote of confidence for people who are potentially going to check it out, because it makes it seem, it's more valid, if you know what I mean. It's just kind of validated by a label's backing and support. So having Holy Roar sign us before the debut album was definitely a huge game changer for us, and it meant that once we did release the album, it was in shops and it had a bit of press and it had reviews, which help people get interested and get the name out there.
So how did it come about that you signed to Holy Roar? Can you kind of talk us through how you sort of met them and how it happened?
Sure. So the main owner of Holy Roar, Alex Fitzpatrick, he used to play in a band called Pariso. We were on tour with the French band Direwolves, which was just a completely DIY tour that we booked and arranged ourselves. We lost loads of money on that tour, but Pariso were one of the other bands playing on that on a show of that tour in Cardiff. And one of them turned up wearing a t-shirt of the comedy show Community, which I was watching at the time. So I just started talking to them about Community, and then we just really hit it off as friends. Like, we just became really, really good friends with the guys in Pariso straight away. It's one of those things you find when you're touring, is you either click with other bands or you don't. You can't sort of force it to happen. But with Pariso, it was just straight away we formed a real connection with them and a bond. And so after that, we actually did several tours with them. We released a split with them. And then obviously through that, Alex got to know us better, and he became more and more interested in Svalbard, to the point where he was like, yeah, okay, I want to release this on my label as well. It's actually just a really nice story of friendship.
And what's it like? What do they do for you? Like, what's sort of the arrangement there?
So it's kind of, Holy Roar is an independent label, so they're not exactly rolling around in money themselves. So it's basically they pay for the pressing and the releases and the PR for us, and we still have to pay to record our albums. So it's not like we get a massive lump sum, but they're there to promote and to produce the physical product for us to sell. So they're very much instrumental in just getting it into as many places and shops as possible. That's pretty much how the deal works. It's not, I think, gone are the days of the big record label advance, you know. A label would give you thousands of pounds and you'd blow it all and have a, you know, that just doesn't really happen anymore. So it's sort of we have to meet halfway in terms of finance and things. But in the end, you know, what we have through Holy Roar is a platform to release our stuff so that it gets seen and heard in the most places as possible.
Yeah. And I mean, there's got to be endless benefits. Like, I think the first time I saw you, maybe the second time, you were opening for Rollo Tomassi at their album release for Grievances. And so you guys were label mates at that time.
Oh my God, I forgot that show.
It was at that really smelly downstairs place.
Power Lunches.
Power
Lunches. Now. Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing that, like, being on a label like Holy Roar, so you're going on tours with all of the other bands, and so you're getting exposure to all of their fan bases. You know, have you seen a kind of a big upturn since then because of that?
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of more of a slow creeping up thing. It hasn't been that, oh, we've played one show with a bigger Holy Roar band like Rollo Tomassi and seen our fan base, you know, and won over every single person in that room. I think that gig especially was probably the opposite of that. We felt like we got a really bad reaction.
No. It was just... Not at all.
Oh, really?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
But that's what got me into you guys.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's cool. That's really nice to hear because, yeah, we worried that gig had been a bit not so good. So yeah. That's a real relief to hear. But, yeah, there's definitely been several incidences. Like, this year in May we're going on tour with Ohms, which will be great. And I think what's been so beneficial is that not every band on Holy Roar sounds the same.
Yeah.
So they've all got sort of different flavors of the underground going on. And so you get, it's complementary when two Holy Roar bands play together. It's not like you would go to a show and get two bands who sound exactly the same. If, say, when we play with Ohms, you're going to get a stoner band and then you're going to get us, and it's two very different things. So that helps us kind of carve out niches within that whole umbrella of Holy Roar. It's the fact that each band is different to the point of complementing each other. But like, we've toured with a couple of Holy Roar bands, we've played a couple of shows and things, and we did the 10-year anniversary show HRX in London, where we got to play like on a really cool big stage with some snazzy lighting.
Yeah.
So there definitely has been like lots of really cool moments that have happened through being on that label.
Yeah.
Like I felt like James Hetfield. It was great.
Svalbard has two vocalists, obviously yourself and Liam. Mm-hmm. How do you decide who sings what and who writes the majority of the lyrics?
I write all the lyrics.
Yep.
Initially, so neither of us wanted to do vocals. We only started doing it because we couldn't find anyone who could do it. So we just went, oh, okay, we'll do it ourselves. And then initially we started deciding who would take what lyric based on who had the easiest guitar part at the time.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
So... like, oh, it's because it's really hard to do vocals and to play guitar at the same time. So usually he'll get a line if his bit's easier, I'll get a line if my bit's easier. But we have changed that approach for the new album because a lot of the lyrics are really sort of centered on feminism and centered on like an autobiographical approach to certain feminist issues where it only made sense that I took the lyrics.
Sure.
So there's a lot more of kind of lyrics that now are just coming straight for me. And then Liam is providing like the backing in the songs. But it's not like that on every song.
Yeah.
So we just, nowadays we just sort of assess it song by song based on the lyrical content and then worry about how we're going to play it live later.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, the lyrical content is something I've noticed, especially in the new track, The Unpaid Intern. It seems you're quite unambiguous in your, you know, lyrical delivery. And there's, and that song for me kind of highlighted it. Is that a bit of punk ethos kind of sneaking through into the music? Obviously, it's intentional.
Yes. I wouldn't use the word punk because I'm not really a fan of punk, but I can see where people would draw that. It's just politics. It's just, it actually, it came about as a really deliberate change for me through a couple of reasons. Mainly writing about music. As a music journalist, you get sent a lot of promo for bands and a lot of albums and things, read through it all and go, this is quite samey. Like, this is quite, I've always felt that metal has kind of just been a bit too poetic and a bit too ambiguous sometimes, especially for a genre that's so angry and so visceral. So I basically wanted to take that anger and make it as direct and as clear and have a message that was completely understandable. Is there are other bands where they'll go, oh, this song's about abortion rights, and you'll go, wow, I had no idea, because it doesn't really say that in the song.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't want there to be any question as to what I'm talking about. I want people to know exactly what these songs are about. I don't want it to be dressed up or to be kind of hidden in by sort of long intellectual words and things. I think, no, if you've got a point to make, just make it.
Yeah.
I think it's quite, not to kind of describe ourselves as refreshing, but I found the process of writing that way really refreshing, because it was just so clear cut.
It almost makes more sense because it's confrontational, right? And so the music is confrontational, and if the lyrics and the delivery are confrontational as well, it is a confrontation of and challenging people's ideas, and not just sort of going, okay, yeah, well, we're singing about abortion rights, but let's all pretend that we're not. We're kind of singing about something else. Whereas in this scenario, it's everyone is very clear on what is happening. I think it's awesome.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So you're a musician, you are a writer, and I found out after that you are an illustrator as well. Where do you find the time and the energy and the source of all the creativity that you've got and that you're outputting?
I'm one of those people who doesn't like to do nothing. I can't bear it. Like, you know, when people go, oh, on the weekend, I just sat around and did nothing. Like, the thought just terrifies me. So there's always, I've always got to be doing something. And I also find the happiest moments for me are when I'm lost in the creative process.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily mean like writing music. It could just mean drawing a picture or writing something down. I really like that immersive feeling that you get when you're just making something from nothing, or taking an idea that's swimming around in your head and actually putting it into a song or putting it into words or to a drawing. So I just sort of live for that process, really. And I don't like being bored, so I just make the time. Like, you know, some people, I have a day job as well, but like most people will go home from their day job and they'll go, oh, I'll just sit in front of the TV for a few hours, or sit on the computer for a few hours. And like, that's great, you know, whatever makes people happy. But for me personally, that doesn't make me happy. I would much rather be creative. I'd much rather just be, using any outlet I can to kind of express something.
Awesome. Awesome. Can you recommend an artist of the week for us? It can be anyone you like, big or small. Someone you've been listening to maybe in the last couple of weeks.
When I'm not illustrating and playing music and everything, I am also a roller coaster enthusiast, and I'm part of a website. We travel the world riding roller coasters, and my biggest musical influence is actually I guess they're described as a company that make music for roller coasters.
Oh my
god. And they're called I love them. They're called IMA Score. So that's IMA, the letters, and Score. And they do soundtracks. They've also started doing soundtracks for films, but they mostly work in the theme park industry, making these beautiful soundtracks for rides. And they're always quite dark and they're always very orchestral. But it's my biggest musical influence. I think they have this magic to their creations, and just such a wide diversity of sounds that they make. So that would be my recommendation for people to check out. Just go to YouTube and type in IMA Score and get ready for your mind to be blown.
So, okay, hold on. You have to expand on that a little bit more. So, firstly, there's roller coaster enthusiasts, which is amazing, but you travel around trying different roller coasters, and it's a whole immersive experience, including music.
Yeah.
Fuck, that's cool.
Well, that isn't the usual reaction. Usually it's, oh, God, that's super nerdy. I mean, it is really nerdy. Like, the enthusiast group that I belong to, we can name different mags that are used for roller coaster systems, different rails and types of coaster. It is really geeky. But I've traveled to Japan, America, Canada, all over the mainland, Europe, and I write about roller coasters. I did a TV show about them over here. And so next week we're going to the big opening of a new coaster at Alton Towers. So the website that I am a staff member of is called coasterforce.com. So if anyone is interested in theme parks or roller coasters, I would highly recommend them checking it out. So there's all sorts of news and information on the website. But cool. It's amazing. It's like amazing social hobby. And I've ridden 532 different roller coasters to date.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so cool. I never even knew that that was a thing. Isn't that awesome? And that's all for this week. Thank you so much to Serena Cherry. Make sure to check out Svalbard at svalbard.bandcamp.com and facebook.com/SvalbardUK. Also, check out coasterforce.com for more information about roller coasting, and also check out the Instagram for Serena's illustrations at SerenaCherryCats. You'll find Serena's choice for Artist of the Week, IMA Score, at imascore.com and facebook.com/imascore. And while you're on Facebook, make sure to like the Musicians Map Facebook page at facebook.com/musiciansmap. This podcast and the website musiciansmap.org is dedicated to sharing knowledge and advice about music and the music industry. It's all about community, honesty, and positive progress. The experiences, stories, and advice shared on the podcast are given freely with the hope that you can relate to them and benefit from them. If you've found this podcast enjoyable or useful, make sure to check out the Musicians Map ebook and audiobook about building success in music. You'll find it at musiciansmap.org/books, Amazon, and Audible. And buying a copy of the book directly contributes to the continuation of this podcast. There's also a free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book to get your copy. If you have a suggestion for the podcast or for the YouTube channel, or you just want to get in touch and say hello, please do so via the Musicians Map Facebook group or by email at kane@musiciansmap.org. Thanks for listening and stay positive.